to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
All right, so today we have the great Scott Horton. Now, if you don't know who Scott Horton is, he is the founder of the Libertarian Institute. He is the editorial director of antiwar.com, host of the Antiwar Radio on Pacific 90.7 FM KPFK in Los Angeles, California, and he podcasts The Scott Horton Show from scotthorton.org. He is the author of the 2017 book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, editor of the 2019 book, The Great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Interviews, 2004 through 2019. He has conducted more than 5,000 interviews since 2003. But most importantly, he is the author of this latest book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, which is what we are talking about today. So welcome to the show, Scott.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's get into this. Now, maybe most of the listeners to the show maybe don't know who you are or what's going on. So let's just talk about this book in kind of a general sense. What is the argument that you're putting forward?
Well, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan got us into this mess by helping to create the terrorist menace. And then H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton turned them against us by stabbing them in the back. And then also Bill Clinton continued to support them throughout the 1990s. As they were an ever-growing danger against the United States. And then after September 11th, W. Bush exploited, and then Obama after him, exploited the terrorist violence against the United States, pretended that nothing from the end of the 20th century had anything to do with the attack. We've been attacked out of the clear blue sky by the evil nihilist, irrational Muslim Islamist terrorists. And so now we had to fight them over there, as broadly defined as anybody could decide, so that we don't have to fight them here. And in the name of all of that, they toppled the governments of Afghanistan and Iraq with full-scale invasions. And then in Libya, in a proxy war. In Syria, a half-regime change, which never succeeded against Damascus, but did end up leading to the rise of the Islamic Caliphate, which was beyond bin Laden's wildest dreams. And then even now, they're continuing to fight, just like in Libya and in Syria, on al-Qaeda's side in the war in Yemen, mostly to try to make up for the fact that Iraq War II had served to empower Iran and their Shiite alliance in the region at the expense of America's allies. And so in order to make it up to America's allies, they've been trying to essentially back the bin Ladenite terrorists against the Shiites ever since. And so now here we are, you know, 20 years later, where actually a majority of the terror wars have been fought on behalf of the enemy against the regional adversary, because that's our government's priorities. And they got 7,000 Americans killed, 7,000 soldiers and Marines killed, but then probably another 7,000 or more contractors. And the reports are just in something on the order of 30,000 suicides of American soldiers and Marines, veterans of the 21st century wars. This doesn't include old World War II, Korea, Vietnam era veterans. This is just veterans of the 21st century wars. 30,000 of them have killed themselves since coming home, and in numbers far outpacing civilian society, which is unusual. And it's cost something like $7 trillion. All of which was just absolutely sunk costs, and it's gotten not just the 21st century, but the whole new millennium, all off on the wrong foot, because the American world empire, you know, in the most cynical and dishonest fashion, exploited the violence of September 11th to accomplish goals that, you know, were in fact contradictory to their own larger interests, even as an empire. And one more, and I really should have said this all along, that this is really what bin Laden was going for with the September 11th attack. The action in asymmetrical political action that includes terrorism, the action is in the reaction of the opposition, so said Saul Alinsky, the leftist radical. And that's right. The whole point of September 11th was to give W. Bush and his government a crisis to exploit so that they would, quote unquote, although they knew it good and well, to overreact and to essentially blow their entire wad on, you know, short-term agendas at the expense of the strength and the health of the overall world empire, which is exactly what they've done. And I don't think anybody would deny, even in all the think tanks in Washington, D.C., that 2003 was the high watermark of American power and influence in the world. And it's all been downhill from there, which is exactly as bin Laden had planned.
It's crazy that we just took the bait and ran with it, you know. There's a whole lot there to unpack, and I want to talk about Syria. But before we get to Syria, let's talk about Iraq War 2.0. There's a whole lot of stuff in here in this book. And I think you had tweeted it at one point. You might have said it maybe on Tom Woods' show or on Dave's show. And you something to the extent of, look, I'm not really giving you anything new that you don't know, right? It's you know all of these things. I'm just kind of connecting the dots for you here. And maybe you haven't thought of it that way. And I really like that quote, because especially if you're of our age, and I'm probably a little older. I just going to turn 51 this fall. But a lot of this stuff I remember. I mean, Jimmy Carter, right? You know, that whole thing and the Iran hostage crisis. I remember that. I remember the tanker war, and you mentioned that in there. But with Iraq 2.0, this is an interesting one. You know, a lot of people said that it was about oil. And I think they were right to an extent. And I think you even mentioned in the book, but, you know, so let's talk about this whole oil issue, because I think it's misunderstood or misconstrued. So kind of explain a little bit, what was the role of oil in Iraq War 2.0?
Oh, I think not much, really. Iraq War 2 was about Israel. And the only role that the oil, that Iraqi oil really played in the war was as part of the Zionists in America, their plan to help bankrupt and destroy Saudi Arabia. So what they wanted to do was to privatize Iraqi oil into as many different companies' hands as possible. They didn't care. To ramp production up in order to break the strength of Saudi Arabia's hold over the OPEC cartel. And then, of course, what happened was once they invaded, James Baker III, the Dark Lord of the Sith and lawyer for every oil company in Houston, let it be known that, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. In fact, there's going to be a national oil company, and it's going to produce as much as we say, which is very little, because this is part of their protectionist racket. It was for 100 years going back, according to Greg Palast, was their deal with the Iranians before and the Saudis now, to keep Iraqi oil off the market as much as possible in order to keep prices artificially high, as low as they were then. They could have been even lower. And so, and of course, their goal being to prop up the Saudi kingdom rather than to bring it down, which, you know, the you know, post Netanyahu Likud party in his second term, Netanyahu Likud party anyway, certainly has had no problem. In fact, even Olmert before him has had no problem getting along with the Saudis. But that was the plan as of 2002 and 3, as drawn up by Elliot Cohen, and I forgot his partner's name there at the Heritage Institute.
Yeah, I think that you hit it right on the head. You know, oil was like a side issue. This is at best a side issue, right?
It was a means to an end. And also, you know, I think it's fair to say too that the overall imperial posture of the United States Pentagon is geared toward the old Cold War with Russia and China that never really ended. And so you can forget, you know, cheap oil prices, cheap gas prices, so you can get to work in the morning, or even, you know, profits for Exxon. And that's obviously part of it. But the major goal there, you know, as far as the Pentagon was concerned, other than trying to weaken an enemy of Israel's, was to weaken China and to prevent, essentially to take control, to keep control of that all-important choke point in the event of a war. You know, as Donald Trump complained, we don't even buy Persian Gulf oil. We're securing the Persian Gulf for China. Why are we paying billions of dollars to secure their oil resources? And and that's why, so we can cut them off if it comes down to it, is why.
Yeah.
It's the same reason they're sending the special operations forces all throughout Africa in the name of counterterrorism, is really to try to keep the Chinese out, because they want to limit. And really all they're doing is pushing them closer toward Russia, right? Where they can trade gas through pipelines across that frontier where we have no say in it whatsoever. So
that, yeah,
it's not a smart strategy, but it's still their strategy, I think.
It's, I guess it's a strategy, not the one I would recommend, but now one of the guys you mentioned, and I don't remember much being said about him in the media, but I don't pay attention to this as much as you do, is David Wormser. And, you know, having read the book, man, David Wormser, I guess if there's a hall of scum, with Dick Cheney being, I guess, the king of the hall of scum, maybe, David Wormser is probably right up there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
What was his role in all this? Because people just don't know who David Wormser is. And I really think the listeners need to know about this guy, especially. So what can we say about David Wormser?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he's essentially a slightly less ugly version of Richard Pearl. So Wormser essentially is a Zionist neoconservative from the, you know, an American. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, definitely an Israel first, and part of that whole group with Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and them. And, you know, he's a fool. He's a damned fool is what he was. And what had happened was that there's an Iranian, really an Iraqi exile named Ahmed Chalabi, but who was working for Iran, who had convinced these neoconservatives. And Wormser was the one who wrote all this down in his policy papers, A Clean Break, Coping with Crumbling States, and then the book, Tyranny's Ally, that here's what we're going to do, and it's going to work great. We got to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And he wasn't promoting invasion in any of those three, by the way. He's promoting a coup, essentially, but an American or Israeli action. To get rid of Saddam Hussein. And then what will happen is the Jordanians will come to dominate Iraq. And it'll be a cousin. We'll send in a cousin of the king of Jordan, or maybe just the king of Jordan himself will take over. And later they replaced that with Ahmed Chalabi himself to be the new ruler of Iraq in the plan. But under the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, they'll just come and replace Saddam Hussein with King Hussein. And then what will happen is they'll be able to influence the Shiite clerics of Najaf and have them influence Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and tell them to stop being friends with Iran and Syria and instead follow their lead and become allies with the Jordanians, Turks, and Israelis. Now, this is just completely crazy and stupid, made no sense whatsoever, and it all hinged upon the idea that the Shiites were going to go along with whatever the Hashemites said, because the Hashemites supposedly are descended from the Prophet Muhammad. And the Shiites, well, they just love being told what to do by anybody with a black turban. Yeah. But that's just not true, right? In fact, the Shiites venerate a certain line of Muhammad's family, but right. That doesn't have a damn thing to do with the Hashemites, who are Sunnis. And, you know, as far as I know, their claims to be literal descendants of Muhammad are much more questionable anyway. They're just, anyway, has nothing to do with the Shiite tradition at all. And when the British had propped up a Hashemite Sunni king over Iraq in the 1920s, the Shiite clergy in Najaf had a fatwa against them and said that it's forbidden for anyone to even cooperate with this king, which is part of what helped to bring him down. So, you know, if David Wormser knew anything about history, he would have known that this guy Chalabi was just blowing sunshine up his rear end, trying to get him to believe whatever he wanted, whatever, you know, they needed to believe in order to get this done. And so, honestly, when you read A Clean Break, it doesn't make much sense until you understand. Yeah, that's because a con artist is essentially playing these guys and telling them what they need to hear, and they're buying it. But for the reader to buy it would be a whole other level of credulity. You know what I mean? Somebody's convinced David Wormser, sure, but
it's crazy. it's crazy. I mean, I remember back to those days. I was sad to say that I was on my last tour in the Navy, and I was a recruiter. God will never probably forgive me for having been a Navy recruiter at that time. But I remember watching the news, and when Iraq had collapsed and all that, they were already talking about going on to the next of these seven countries. And I'm like, okay, but like, what if, I mean, we don't even know if Afghanistan, this is right, 2003. Like, we don't even know that Afghanistan is finished, and we're already on to Iraq. And then now we're not even quite done with that. And we're already looking to Iran and Syria and Libya. I mean, who are these people? They're crazy. They're insane. And that was 2003. And that was really kind of my awakening to all of this. I mean, I did follow Harry Brown a little bit in 96, but I think what finally, I guess, was the blue pill, so to speak, for me was just the insanity in 2003, you know, as I'm trying to put people in the Navy. And at the same time, I'm watching this on the news going, what the heck? I mean, these guys are nuts. And I think David Wormser is probably as you put it, great. He's a con artist, and he convinced all these guys of what they already wanted to be convinced of anyways, right? They wanted this. And so, yeah, sure, it's going to work out fine. We'll just put this Hashemite king in here and everything's okay. But really? It's insane.
Yeah. And so this was the plan in the 90s. And then George W. Bush hired them all. Dick Cheney hired all the neocons. And they ran the vice president's office, the National Security Council, the State Department, and the Defense Department. And Colin Powell complained that this was a separate government, this sort of parallel government that Cheney had set up to just do an end run around all the professionals who knew better, and including him. And of course, he clicked his heels and went along with this. But I'm just saying, Powell characterized it this way, that this was sort of a coup. I mean, the Americans knew that they elected the Republicans. They didn't know that they had elected the Likud.
That's right.
You know, they didn't realize that they're, you know, essentially these are Netanyahu's men, not even Ariel Sharon's men, who was the prime minister at the time. These are Benjamin Netanyahu's men.
Yeah.
You know, the other half of Likud in waiting, you know, at the time. And this was Netanyahu's guys and their plan. And this is what we should do. And now look, so what happened instead? What happened instead was Iran won the war. What happened instead was that the supermajority Shiites had no intention of going along with the Jordanians, who exercised virtually no influence whatsoever during the entire years of that war. And it was Chalabi's paymasters, the Iranians, who ended up inheriting all the power. And once the Americans realized, or I guess by the time the Americans realized, that the groups we're putting in power don't really need us, they have, first of all, a supermajority population of the country backing them, and secondly, an alliance with their Iranians next door, their co-religionists in Iran next door. It was too late. There was essentially no turning back by then. And so they finished the war. They fought essentially a five-year civil war on behalf of the side that they hated, not the side that had attacked us, but in fighting for the side that the American Empire hated, the Iranians and the Shiites. They ended up pushing the Sunnis of Iraq, where there had never been a terrorist problem before. There had never been a suicide bombing the entire history of Iraq before 2003, and ended up pushing the Iraqi Sunni population into a full-scale insurgency, and including an alliance with a whole new generation of bin Ladenites. They call themselves, at a year and a half into the war, the end of 04, Zarqawi finally declared his loyalty to bin Laden and named his group Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. And that's the group that later became the Islamic State, was the group that Zarqawi had founded there, and that, you know, the Iraqis were pushed into alliance. So you had essentially a very secular society, not atheistic. It was a religious society, but it wasn't a religious government. It was secularist state. And it was not a land of religious fundamentalism like it is in Saudi Arabia, America's ally, for example. And, you know, I wouldn't cite him too often, but credit where it's due. Michael Moore, in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11, showed Baghdad before the war.
Yeah.
And there's a lady with no hat wearing blue jeans on her way to go teach college. And that was the society that we were overthrowing and then pushing into the arms of a bunch of bin Ladenite, you know, Wahhabi and Salafi suicide bomber, head chopper, and and extremely backwards Islamists, meaning, you know, theocrats.
Yeah.
You know, not preachers, but preachers with police power.
Yeah, exactly.
And set them back generations in that regard. One of the most, you know, with Egypt and Jordan and Syria, you know, one of the more westernized Arab states. And so turned over the east and the south of the country over to Iran's best friends, and turned the west of the country over to Osama bin Laden's best friends. And then the supermajority told Bush, now, thanks for everything, get the hell out. And so that was how we lost that war, was by winning it for people who hated us.
And I think you mentioned this in the book when you're talking about Syria and us, and we can get into Syria in a minute. But it's, I mean, so far, the word that keeps popping into my head is schizophrenic. This policy, American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, it's just schizophrenic. It bounces. These people don't really understand anything about this area. They're not intellectually curious about the Middle East. If they go over there, it's for a couple of days, and, you know, they hang out with the king of Saudi Arabia or whatnot, and that's it. They have no idea what they're doing. And I mean, they're like the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop or whatnot that's just going through and breaking everything.
Yep. And look, they thought it was going to be easy because some guy told them it was going to be easy.
Yep.
Yeah. And yep. Bush famously asked, what is all this about Sunni and Shia? I thought they were all Muslims. And this is just on the eve of war.
Yeah.
You know, when it was, quote unquote, too late for him to turn back now after all the S he had talked leading up to that. And so, you know, it's funny. One of the reasons I knew better than this, which I knew better than this for a lot of reasons, but there was a Tom Clancy book, mm-hmm. you know, the fictional war guy.
I love Tom Clancy. I mean, I don't love him, but his books are fantastic.
Yeah, well, and they're very popular, right? It's the kind of thing that, like, it should have had it sunk its way into some imaginations in D.C., at least. And this is the kind of thing people read on the weekends. And in the military and in the national security state, among the congressmen and their staff, they read Tom Clancy. Well, one of his books that came out in like 2000, or maybe even 01, I forget which one it was, but the book starts out with a secret Shiite sleeper agent is on Saddam Hussein's security detail and shoots him in the back of the head at a parade and kills him. And then what happens? Iran takes over the entire country in about a week because the supermajority Shiite population are under the sway of the Ayatollah. They do whatever he says, not whatever Chalabi says, not whatever the Hashemite king says, but what the Ayatollah in Iran says. And part of the backdrop of the story actually is how the Ayatollah is constantly being bothered by the Shiite Sunni schism in Iraq, and how the new Shiite government is having a hard time making the Sunnis obey their, you know, edicts and this and that kind of thing. So in the book, they just take right over like a coup de main, right? Like Russia in Crimea or Hitler in Austria, right? It's not even a war or a battle. They just take over because they say so. They got a megaphone. We rule now. And then that's it. And they take over the whole place. And so, I mean, that was one of the reasons that I was saying that you shouldn't be doing this. In fact, I actually have a clip from 2002 where I get Sunni and Shia backwards on the radio with my friend. Yeah. I go, yes, because the Iranians and the Sunnis next door, they're going to take over the whole thing. Where I was in pirate radio in a garage off the top of my head. I didn't have the article in front of me or whatever. But I was thinking about this already. And this is, you know, a solid 6 months before the invasion.
Oh, man.
That, you know, even though I had the names backwards, I was right that these people don't need us, right? Once we get rid of their enemy for them, you're going to have the supermajority, and then they're not going to be compliant. Why would they be, you know? And that was your friend, the idiot, doing pirate radio in his friend's garage 6 months before the war started. But, you know, meanwhile, they're telling us, yeah, no, don't worry, it's going to be fine. In fact, famously, The Onion ran a point counterpoint in The Onion. And the point was, this is going to be chaos. It's going to increase Iran's power. It's going to increase Osama bin Laden's power and influence. and spread terrorism throughout the region. It's going to cost all this money. Our guys are going to get bogged down in urban warfare, getting shot at and blown up, and it's going to be a disaster. We should definitely not do this. And then counterpoint was, nuh-uh, it's going to be great. You don't know what you're talking about. And all those things that you say are going to happen are not going to happen. Don't worry about it. And then that was it. And that's The Onion months before the invasion. So, you know, for people go, oh, well, everybody thought he had weapons. Everybody thought we had to do it. Yeah, everybody means you, not us. There are plenty of people who knew better. There, you know, in Austin, Texas, there were 50,000 people turned out to protest against the start of the war. And I bet you 2/3 of the population of the city and Travis County were against it, even if they didn't show up to protest against it. And that's just here. And every major city in America had massive protests in February, March of 2015. Millions and millions of Americans opposed it before it started. So that just means that everybody, you know, who was for it, have that less of an excuse, and certainly not when they try to blame everybody but themselves, you know, and say that everybody believed, because it's just not true.
That's right. That's right. So Syria, gosh, Syria's in the news. And Syria, I mean, you do a great job in the book of breaking. I mean, it's really it's quite complex, but you break it down. You know, I'm interested, though, in how we went from using Syria at one point, and you even mentioned, you know, during and after the first war against Iraq, Syria was on board with the whole coalition. And then we even used them as a rendition country. But then something changes, and they go from, I mean, I don't know if I'd say an ally, maybe, you know, a nominal friendly country, to suddenly we need regime change. And we're fighting on the side of Al-Qaeda, essentially, in Syria.
Yeah.
How the heck does that happen?
Well, so this is all trying to make up for the war for Iran in Iraq. Now, I mention this constantly. I'm sure people are sick and tired of hearing me say this. I mention it in every speech and every interview that I can think of, too. And that is this all-important article by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine from March 2007. It's called The Redirection. And really, I recommend you read it. I mean, it's a lot of fun. Read it twice. You'll laugh. You'll cry. You'll say, are you effing kidding me? That this is, wow, they really, those are the things that they say, huh? Oh, my God. So there it is. And what it is, oops, we screwed up. We just fought a war for our regional adversary, independent Shiite Iran that we hate. And so now we have to make it up to the Saudi king and the rest of the Sunni alliance on the American side in the region by turning back in Al-Qaeda. The Saudis don't have a land army. The Saudis have suicide bomber, you know, head chopper, bin Ladenite shock troops is who they have. And so Khalilzad goes in 2006, the beginning of 06, he goes to Saudi, and the Saudi king says, listen, it was always you and me and Saddam against Iran. Now you've given Iraq to Iran on a golden platter. What are you going to do about it? And Khalilzad says, we're at your service, your highness. That's it. And, you know, Cheney went over and had a visit over there the same year, got read the Riot Act the same way. And they said, okay, this is it. The policy is the redirection. And it was so obvious at the time, too, that the way that they did this, they said, you know, the problem in the region, Sunni, Shia, what's that? I don't know what you're talking about. You know what it is? You know, Riyadh, Tehran? No, I don't know what those mean. The problem in the region, it's moderates versus extremists. And by switching the subject to that, we're just going to ignore all the real definitions that count about who's on whose side and what we're doing as cover to change sides in the war, to go back to the good old policy of the Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Bill Clinton years of backing these terrorists as though September 11th had never happened, as though all of the worst casualties on the American side in Iraq War II, when we had 4,500 killed of servicemen, 500 of which were killed fighting the Shiites, 4,000 of which were killed fighting the Sunnis, of which the worst, you know, bleeding edge of that was Al Qaeda in Iraq, the Bin Ladenites. And we're just going to pretend all that never happened. And we're just going to go back to backing Al Qaeda again, because that's what the king of Saudi Arabia wants. And so then the next thing that, well, first of all, still, this is 06, under W. Bush still, for two more years, that they started backing Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon and Muslim Brotherhood groups in Syria. And it was Liz Cheney, the current House representative from Wyoming, who at that time worked in the State Department under W. Bush, who took the lead in backing the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. And then they also backed a group of essentially, you know, the PKK and the YPG, the leftist Kurds in Turkey and Syria. Well, they have an Iranian branch called PJAC. And then there was also another group of anti-Iranian terrorists who were Bin Ladenites called Jundala, who were really dangerous guys, head chopper, suicide bomber types, fighting in Baluchistan in the region in southeastern Iran. And so, and you got to read the whole series of Seymour Hersh from 07, especially the Iran plans and the coming wars and a couple others like that, preparing the battlefield. You got to read kind of through the whole series, but it's all essentially centered around the redirection. Oops, we gave Baghdad to Tehran. So now we're looking for consolation prizes to see what we can do to, you know, ameliorate the consequences of this for our friends. And so I'll skip Libya real quick, but just to say that was one of them. The Libyan veterans of Iraq War II who'd gone and fought the Americans in Iraq War II. They came home and Obama took their side. Just as he's killing Osama bin Laden in Pakistan in the spring of 2011, he's taken Osama's side in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia and al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in their attempt to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Fought a 9-year air war for them and, you know, backed by Qatar and Saudi. And then the worst part of it all, and it goes on and on, because that war spread throughout Africa, led to the refugee crisis of 2015-16. And all this stuff. But the very worst part of it was that they then took the jihadis and the guns and they started shipping them off to Syria to try to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. Now we're going right back to the clean break. What's the problem? The problem is Iran backs Hezbollah by way of Syria. And so they said in the clean break, therefore, we ought to get rid of Saddam Hussein. No, dummies. That just made everything worse. That put another major power in the block, in the line, in Iran's camp. So, okay, well, consolation prize, we'll try to take out Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And that's what it was all about from the very beginning. And for the people who were looking closely, we knew from the spring of 2011, John Hanna, who had been Dick Cheney's man, one of the official real neoconservatives from Dick Cheney's office in the Bush years, wrote a piece for Foreign Policy in April 2011, said Prince Bandar has come to power as the intelligence chief now in Saudi Arabia, and he started sending fighters off to Syria. And then all through that summer, we knew from Alistair Crook and Eric Margolis and others, and then later confirmed in the Stratfor leak emails that NATO forces were on the ground in Lebanon and in Turkey, training the jihadists and setting up the war all through 2011. And so, you know, they'll say, oh, the covert action started in 2013. Nuh-uh, it did not either, man. And once they say to you, look, the Saudis are sending fighters, what does that mean? That means, yeah, Al-Qaeda terrorists, the same guys that were the worst part of the Sunni insurgency that fought the Americans and the Shiites in Iraq War II. Now we're sending them off to Syria. So that's it. You know, from the very beginning, there's poison in that chalice, and they can call it moderate rebels and then call it a popular revolution, and they can pretend all the people fighting are leftists or whatever they want. But the reality is, no, we already know that that's not true. We already know that it's Saudi-backed Bin Ladenite terrorists are heading this thing up. And then, now here's the part we skipped from Iraq War II, but people will remember this, that the local Sunni insurgency made a deal with the Americans and turned on Al-Qaeda. It wasn't the Americans and the Shiites who defeated Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was the local Sunni insurgency, their allies, who turned on them and stabbed them in the back because they were sick and tired of a bunch of Saudis and Egyptians telling them what to do, quite frankly. And because that was a compromise. And really, Petraeus only got at the head of that parade. They already had that policy of getting rid of these guys. They'd turned Sarkawi over to the Americans who bombed him in 2006. But then at the beginning of 07, Petraeus took credit for all this and gave them guns and money and said, as long as you'll help keep Al-Qaeda down, then we won't fight you anymore and you'll have a ceasefire from us or whatever. Well, this is just a miracle, okay? I don't believe in miracles, but if you believe in miracles, wow. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq went from not existing to something like 10,000 men to something like not existing again because the local Sunni tribal leaders took care of the problem for us and for all of humanity. Wow, thanks, guys. That's really nice of you to take care of that problem for yourselves and therefore all of the rest of us too. But then what's Barack Obama do? He comes in with the shock paddles, the defibrillator thing, and he resuscitates them right back to life again, where they had nowhere to go, nothing to do. They're cornered. They're surrounded by enemies. And Obama goes and turns all of eastern Syria into a massive new battlefield for them to join, which is exactly what they did, and brought Al-Qaeda in Iraq back to life. And because there was dissension inside the Obama government about this, especially inside the State Department, it was by the end of 2012, the State Department admitted, and I love this. You go back and look at the press release. It's got Victoria Nuland's name on it. She's the State Department spokesman and admits right there, my framing admits, but yeah, what are you going to call it? Yeah. That, yes, it actually Jabhat al-Nusra is just an alias. That was the State Department's term, an alias for Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Just like Scott Horton already told you so this whole time. And so then that's it. In fact, it was almost a year before that where Hillary Clinton had said at the end of February 2012 in an interview with CBS News, when he's asking her, why aren't we doing more to get rid of Assad? And she says, well, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, has endorsed the revolution in Syria. Are we backing Al-Qaeda in Syria? And now, if you asked her, she would say, look, she only ever wanted to back the moderates. And yeah, she was concerned that by backing the moderates, she would end up backing Al-Qaeda. But she argued that, no, if we just really, really back the moderates, then that'll marginalize the extremists and everything will turn out fine. But that was crazy and wrong and stupid. And there are so many good people who've written about this. But really, the best one is William Van Wagenen, who's written about this for the Libertarian Institute at length, where he just says the FSA is Al-Qaeda. There is no such thing as the moderate rebels in Syria. That was essentially all a ruse. Those guys' job was collecting the money and the guns and all of the best fighters. You know, all this stuff is fungible. And, you know, you take the guys who are, you know, the least religiously radicalized to go and meet with the Americans and collect all the aid. But it goes right to the guys who are leading the fight. And from the very beginning, the guys who were leading the fight were the bin Ladenites. Whether it was, Jabhat al-Nusra or Jaish al-Islam or Ahrar al-Sham, all of these groups were all bin Ladenites. Ahrar al-Sham had been founded by one of the original partners of bin Laden from the 80s war. And then, so it was like that for about 2 years. And then there was a split between essentially the Iraqi-dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria and the Syrian-dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria. And so the Syrian-dominated faction split under Jolani, and Baghdadi, the leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Iraqi-dominated faction, split. And he split from Zawahiri's authority too. Now, maybe bin Laden could have held things together, but America had killed bin Laden, so he wasn't there. And Baghdadi took the line that you've made your law, but let's see you enforce it. And so essentially because, you know, the Al-Qaeda doctrine had always been to just keep fighting until the Americans are finally gone, and then we can create our caliphate then. Because otherwise the Americans will just come and bomb it off the face of the earth. Baghdadi apparently thought that, geez, as long as America's on our side in this one, we might as well go for it now, right? So he declared an Islamic state in eastern Syria in the spring of 2013, and he murdered the leader of Ahrar al-Sham that Zawahiri had appointed to be the negotiator between al-Nusra and ISIS, and he created his own little Islamic state. And then it was like 6 months after that, that Barack Obama was asked about ISIS and compared them to the junior varsity team. And so when the junior varsity team puts on a Kobe jersey, that doesn't make them the pros or something like that, to the New Yorker magazine, after they had hoisted the black flag over Fallujah, which is the next major city west of Baghdad. Yeah. And so this is just absolute denial and just willful ignorance on the part of the president that this is not a big deal. And if you go back and check my archives from the spring of 2014, you can hear me interviewing every Al-Qaeda expert I can think of, every reporter I know, every former CIA officer I know, everybody I know, to say, look at what's going on right here, where Western Iraq, predominantly Sunni Iraq, is essentially wide open for the taking. The Shiite government that America created in Iraq, it only rules Shiistan and in alliance with the Kurds in the north, but they don't really, you know, have much authority over Western Iraq. It's essentially wide open territory. That was how ISIS was able to raise the black flag over Fallujah in January of 2014. And they took it down not long after that. But still, it's like, who's there to stop them? And so that whole spring, I was just warning, oh, man, here it comes. This is the greatest thing. In fact, that Michael Scheuer, the former CIA chief, he's going, oh, I think the worst bin Laden place now is Nigeria. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you not looking at what's going on in eastern Syria and western Iraq right now? It's on. What do they call their group? It's not Al-Qaeda in Iraq. What's the name of the group? The Islamic State. They are wearing their intentions right on their sleeves. And what do you think they're going to do? And so that was it. And then I was right. In June of 2014, they rolled right into Western Iraq in giant convoy. They sacked Mosul and eventually Ramadi, but to Crete and Baiji and officially took over Fallujah and seized essentially all of Western Iraq. And along with Eastern Syria, erased the border between Iraq and Syria, the old Duran line left over from after World War I, and declared the Islamist caliphate. And Baghdadi renamed himself the Caliph Ibrahim and stood up there on the balcony like he's Mussolini announcing his new dictatorship. And might as well have been Osama bin Laden himself. Bin Laden had died 2 years previously, and here is his DNA clone standing up there saying exactly what he would have said. Ha ha, look at me. I just created my own bin Ladenite state, and you can't do anything about it. And then, so what did Obama do? He started Iraq War III. He actually waited until they really needed the help to try to extort them a little bit. But then in August of 2014, he launched a massive war on behalf of who? On behalf of the same Shiites that he wished that our government, Bush and his government, wished that they had not fought Iraq War II for. And they fought Iraq War III for them now to abolish the radical Sunni bin Ladenite state, which they had built up in order to spite these Shiites in the first place. Right. And ended up fighting an entire thing. I cite in the book where in the Battle of Tikrit, the Iranians on the ground say, we got to admit we couldn't have done it without the American air power supporting us. We got to appreciate it. And then the Americans say the same thing. We got to admit we're flying air support for the Iranians on the ground. We're the Iranian Air Force. John McCain complained, we're Iran's Air Force in Iraq. But it's like, whose fault is that, John McCain, who overthrew Saddam Hussein and who tried to overthrow Assad and who supported every bit of this policy that led to this? And why do you think we're fighting on the side of the Shiites? To destroy the caliphate that we built to spite them after fighting a war for them that we wish we hadn't fought for them the last time around. Not that anybody could have pounded through his thick skull with a chisel and a hammer.
it's... Did we say schizophrenic?
It's completely crazy, man.
So basically, and you've hit on it, and I want to just put this out there so the listeners get it. I mean, really, the book drives home the point that this is bipartisan in nature, you know, because some people might think that, well, they think war on terror, George Bush, Republican Party, neocons. Okay, so I'm just going to support the Democrat guy, you know, but the Democrats were just in bed with this. I mean, Joe Biden was the water carrier for this in the Senate.
And when the policy changes, you'll notice the policy changes in the middle of presidencies. right? Yes. When we decided to turn against Saddam Hussein was in the middle of H.W. Bush. That wasn't because now Bill Clinton got elected and now we're going to have a different Iraq policy. Bill Clinton kept H.W. Bush's Iraq policy, right? Yeah. And then the change there didn't come until 2 years into W. Bush. And then the redirection comes in 2006. This is the policy, you know, honestly, people really believe that Obama must be under the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood. He must be under the influence of, you know, these radical right-wing Islamist groups, or he must be himself a secret Muslim from Kenya, or all these things. But the reality was the reason Obama committed this treason is because he was W. Bush. He picked up the exact policy from his predecessor and simply continued it on. It was Bush who was back in Jandala and Fatah al-Islam and the Muslim Brotherhood. It was Obama who continued to do so. You know, he scaled it up a hell of a lot. You'll notice all of these big shifts. Same thing if you go back. The policy of backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the policy of backing Saddam Hussein against Iran and building up all the bases in the Middle East, all that started with Jimmy Carter. And you can point the finger at Ronald Reagan and said he did all three of those things too. That's right. He continued those exact same policies all the way through. And so it is absolutely bipartisan, nonpartisan, transpartisan in all of the guilt here. And if you're looking for a side to apologize for, you know, you're only doing yourself a disservice, essentially, you know, by failing to come to grips with half the truth of the story of what's going on here. You know, there's no way to spin Bill Clinton as any less murderous than W. Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump, for that matter. People go to the mat for Donald Trump constantly. Donald Trump, all he ever wanted to do was end the wars. Well, that's sort of kind of right, but he never did it.
That's right.
He didn't have the wherewithal to close the deal.
That's right.
And say, look, we're going to end this war, and we're going to end this war, and we're going to end this war because I say so. And if he'd stuck to it, they would have had to obey him. But he never made them obey him, right? He said, I want out of Korea and I want out of Afghanistan. And James Mattis just said, nah, that's what you think. I'm not doing that. But then did he follow up the next day and the next day and the next day? No, he didn't follow up. He didn't say, I thought I gave you an order to get my guys out of Afghanistan. That never happened.
That's right.
They kicked the can down the road a little bit. And the next thing you know, he's signing on to an escalation. Okay, here's 10,000 more troops and 10,000 more airstrikes. And for what? You know?
He was spineless. I mean, if he would have said, look, General Mattis, I am the bloody commander-in-chief. I gave you an order, and you will follow it. I am the commander-in-chief, and kept pounding that. At some point, they're going to have to click their heels and salute.
Yep, same thing in Syria. And people are absolutely right to say that they were insubordinate in Syria. He said, I want out of Syria. And they said, no. But then here's the thing. He gave in.
That's right.
The story doesn't end with they said no. The story ends with him saying, oh, okay, never mind then. And he backed down twice in 2018 and 19 over withdrawal from Syria because his inferiors told him what to do.
Yep.
I mean, this is analogous to your kid telling you what your bedtime is. How is it that that's the way it works around here? That's not how it's supposed to work around here.
And yet
he did what they said over and over and over again. And in fact, we know from Gareth Porter's great reporting that after the election, when he appointed a new Secretary of Defense and the anti-war conservative Colonel Douglas McGregor to be advisor to the new Secretary of Defense, that McGregor came to him with a plan to get the troops all the way out of Afghanistan by the end of the year. And he signed it. And then the next day, the military cried and he unsigned it.
And you know, when
there's nobody to blame for that but Donald J. Trump, period. That's it.
That's right. It's his fault. And when we say the military is complaining about it, I want people to know it's not the average soldier or sailor or Marine that's complaining. They're ready to come home.
No, we mean the chiefs, the generals who rule the Pentagon Empire. It's entirely different.
In the rear with the gear that are going to get out and make millions of dollars when they work for Boeing or Raytheon or any of these defense contractors. It's not the average Joe Sailor who's sitting there saying, man, I'm ready to come home. I'm done with this.
Hey, look, and I can testify to that. I mean, some substantial proportion of my audience are anti-war veterans and of antiwar.com's audience. I did an event. Well, I've been doing events all spring long at Libertarian Party groups, which it's not exactly a random sample, but man, have I met a lot of anti-war veterans, and including some who are anti-war because of things that they heard from me. But more importantly, just they had their own stories. You know what did it for me? I was deployed here and I saw this and I knew that I couldn't do this anymore. And I heard 100 of them, you know, over and over and over again. I hear from guys that was when I knew that this is not the right thing and we should not be doing this. And I had to get out of there and that kind of deal. So, you know, it's been 20 years. And so that means we got millions of stories. We got millions of guys who've been to the terror wars and back and who know better now. And you got to feel bad for them too, man. I do. You know, there are guys who lost their best friends over there.
Yep.
Now they got to look at it for what did they die for?
Nothing.
To fight Muqtada al-Sadr
in
eastern Baghdad for what? He's still one of the most powerful Shiite leaders in the country to this day. No prime minister is prime minister without his assent.
That's right. That's right. It's crazy.
What the hell are our guys fighting him for over there?
I was thinking the other day, one of the guys that I was a recruiter with, he was a Navy corpsman, and he went with the Marines in 2006 into Iraq, and he was killed. He was only there for about a week, and his daughter was born 2 days before he shipped out, and he saw his daughter that once, and that was it. And you know, I was just thinking the other day, man, she's like 15 years old now. That's insane. And,
it is.
You know?
It's a betrayal of the worst order.
It is.
And going back to, you talked about how back then in 2002 and whatever that, you knew this ain't right. But think of all the people who they knew it too and suppressed all that and chose instead to believe. Yep. You know, the American people, on one hand, there's nothing we could do about it. On the other hand, that's really not right. Reality is, and it ain't like W. Bush was Ronald Reagan's son. He was Bush's son.
Yeah.
What benefit of the doubt did he deserve?
No.
You know, he's on the job for 8 months before the worst catastrophe inflicted by a foreign enemy. And then he gets full benefit of the doubt.
Yep.
And a 90% approval rating. No one holds it against him whatsoever. Has anybody ever expected you to be doing your job when you'd only been hired 8 months ago? You got to start doing. Oh, come on. I haven't even been on the job a year. I got to actually start doing my job now. And it was in a substantial way. American society went along with all of this. The American people. You know, I was pleading not guilty on behalf of so many of us a little while ago. But at the same time, even the anti-war movement, after March the 15th, that was it. They started the war a couple days later, and that was the end of the large-scale anti-war movement. The Democrats came and propped up a kind of fake one around Cindy Sheehan and her valiant efforts in 05 and 06. But the Democrats just exploited that to come back to power in the 06 elections, and they haven't given a damn about anti-war since then. And most of the left anti-war movement, I mean, there are great anti-war writers on the left, of course, and journalists, but the broad movement of it is gone. Yep. The liberals don't care. And right-wingers are turning against the war, but it sure is late in the game. Yeah. And it's not enough, right? You see... In the polls, they do this every year. It's an open-ended question, not multiple choice. Open-ended question. What's your concern? What do you think are the issues that are the most important facing America this year? And the wars aren't ever on the list.
No.
And it'll be top 35, top 40 answers. And Afghanistan's not on there, ever.
No.
And so the American people do oppose it, but just a little. They oppose it by super majorities, but without any vigor.
That's right.
You know, without prioritizing it.
Amen.
And so it ends up, you know, we just go on like this. And even now, it's like, are we getting out of Afghanistan because the American people demanded an end to it? No, it's because the Taliban won the war.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And
so we would have had to send a now, I guess it's true that they know they couldn't send another 50,000 troops in there without the American people screaming about it. But still, it's been 20 years.
It's time. It's time. Well, thanks very much, Scott. Wow. That was almost an hour. And I could probably do this another hour or three, but you've got to go and I've got to go. So let's do this again sometime. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Scott.
Absolutely. Happy to do it anytime and really appreciate your time, Sean.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All righty. Well, that's it for today's episode. This is the fourth and final bonus episode that we are offering here in July in celebration of our fourth anniversary. So I hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget, you can find Scott Horton, the great Scott Horton. He is amazing, as you just saw. He's like a walking encyclopedia when it comes to American foreign policy. You can find him at scotthorton.org. His archive is there with all of his interviews, and it's at this point well over 5,000 interviews. You can also find him at antiwar.com and at thelibertarianinstitute.org. And in the show notes page, you will find two links to his books. The first one is, of course, Enough's Enough, Time to End the War on Terrorism. That's the latest one. But I'm also going to link his earlier book on the war in Afghanistan called Fool's Errand. And I would suggest that everyone listening to this show should go out, click on those links, and get those books. You will thank me, no doubt about it. All right, well, thank you very much. Have a good day, and we'll see you next time with the introductory episode to Season 4, The War in the Pacific. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.